And so he is always has gone out of his way to support what we're doing here. And I want to introduce my friend John Garrett.
Since the news account said that the cancellation was because of material unsuitable for young ears. Clearly something else was worked because they canceled the meeting that evening with the parents too. Those were older ears, I'd assume. So some naughty ideas, potentially dangerous if heard by ears of any age, were interdicted by the Hudson, New York School District, a very, very prosperous community. You'll have to take my word. I never raised my voice with the student audience. I never cursed. I did not expose myself. And I didn't urge students to tear the school apart. The entire point of the talk dealt with the corrosive tensions which pollute any institutional school experience from kindergarten through college and are virtually only escapable reliably in one or two ways, either by homeschooling through the method called unschooling or by developing an active critical consciousness adequate to blocking out threats and intimidations directed from the school establishment, from the general press, based on the relationship between school and one's future. For example, neither bad grades nor bad standardized test scores has any decisive effect on a young person's future, except in one instance, and that is where the individual believes that they will and acts accordingly, becoming, in effect, his or her own jailer. The correct way to regard standardized tests, and I'll be attempting to prove this later on, the correct way to regard standardized tests if one lacks the courage simply to refuse to take them. The correct way to regard grades is to adopt Alice in Wonderland's defense against empty menaces and say, why, you're only just a pack of cards. Don't worry that I'll beg that question on this important subject. Just ahead, I'll try to prove my case, but for now, the task is simply laying its background for my symbolic defenestration from Highland High School on March 25th, 2004. When I began to talk about grades and test scores to the junior and senior class in Highland High School, you could have heard a pin drop in that auditorium packed with young people who had been threatened over and over again on a daily basis for years about the terrible things that were going to happen. Let me back up a little here and fill in some blanks. In early January of 2004, I was contacted at my New York City apartment by a member of the Hudson School Board, a prosperous town in Rockland County, north of the Tappan Zee Bridge, 45 miles from New York City. I was so thrilled to get an opportunity to speak near my home that completely unasked, I quoted a fee two-thirds less than my usual charge. Since stepping away from 30 years of public school classroom teaching as New York State Teacher of the Year in 1991, I had spoken to over 1,000 audiences in all 50 states and 9 foreign countries, including an invitation to give a keynote address at Australia's National School Leadership Conference in Perth. I can remember saying, when I got the phone call, this is school administrator? Yes, he said. I said, are you sure you have the right person? Anyway, so I've had invitations to the White House, to NASA Space Center, to Apple Computer, and to many corporations like United Technologies up in Hartford. But hardly ever have I been asked to speak in New York. That puzzled me and hurt my feelings a little. So I jumped at the chance to speak at Highland High School. day rolled around, up the Hudson River I drove. I was met by the school board house, in due course, with a lump in my throat, found myself standing in front of an auditorium full of nice young men and women who had been filled lifelong with lies, half-truths, time-wasting irrelevancies, and vague fears that their lives would be ruined if they failed to make the right college, or any college at all. My wife said, don't say that makes sense, it'll be controversial. The biggest lie, of course, is that they were children at all. The childhood lie is the most malign lie of all the bunch. Where childhood stops precisely is anybody's guess, varying with the individual. But the verdict of all human history is far too overwhelming to ignore. Nobody, absolutely nobody, is a child at age 12. Except for that mass of unfortunate lab animals whose childhood has been artificially extended for many reasons, some of them sentimental, some of them sinister. The price these grown-up children pay is pain, long and strong, often lifelong. The easiest way to achieve prodigies of accomplishment with young people is to get out of their way and let them grow up. And since in the childish utopia our society has become since the end of World War II, that isn't likely to happen on its own. For those laggards, a process must be fashioned to hold their feet to the fire, to stimulate their imaginations, to direct their energies to production of something valuable instead of memorization. But back to the auditorium of Highland High School, where I began by a few remarks, such as when you have heard. We're out of the maze of specific thematic threads I might have followed. I made a command decision on the spot to hit hard two assumptions which poison the judgment of young people. Bet on the awesome challenge of learning to self-organize. You'll recall, I know, I'm saying sarcastically, that Immanuel Kant in Critique of Practical Reason, close to being the most unreadable book ever written, at least in translation from the German, argued that unless you self-organize your life, A, you hardly can be said to have a life at all, and B, you certainly are condemned to being immoral lifelong, because people who follow the instructions of others and don't generate their own internal morality that they test them in situations can't be trusted in any situation that requires a moral decision. That was more than 200 years ago he wrote that. And people who read German, I guess, read that all the time. So I made the decision to attack two assumptions that I thought broke the power of kids and their parents to allow this self-organization to take place, which intimidated the parents from their natural role as their own kids' allies and got them recruited into the army of people who sought to impose the formal stamp on them. The first assumption is that college is the essential goal of all schoolwork, and that whatever it costs in time, money, and sacrifice, it's a consummation devoutly to be pursued. And the second assumption is that merit and talent is scientifically measured by testing. Thus, every effort should be made to memorize what one is told to memorize, focus on what is selected for focus by the authorities in charge of your time. I began by pointing out the enormous expense of time, money, and attention which college requires. The average time required for a degree degree completion being 6 years, not four, then provided, for what was obviously the first time in their lives, a significant, inexpensive, time-economical alternative route to the undergraduate degree in half the time for half the money. This could have been done from first grade on, and that is by taking the degree from perfectly respectable colleges through the internet. It used to be through correspondence. I assume it's through the internet right now. Dozens of excellent schools, including the state systems of California, including UCal, Berkeley, the state system of New York, the state system of New Jersey, provide this option. It's quite possible to secure a BA in 2 years at a half the cost of a chair, or less than that. Shouldn't that be common knowledge? I guess that's a rhetorical question. Several schools of excellent reputation, including McGill in Canada, which is sometimes referred to as the Harvard of Canada, and the University of South Africa, will allow this through the PhD. Same degree, same diploma, no designation saying that this one was taken, you know, on the internet. The business aspect of schooling has to be underlined if students are to be helpful to clear thinking in their decisions. Never give it. Nobody can give you an education. Nobody. And I'll tell you in a moment why Harvard, Yale, and Princeton can't either. And I think I can tell you in such a way that the evidence is compelling anyway. So it's never given. And anybody who thinks it is, including a 10-year-old, is a fool. Without energetic self-organization, education is impossible. It just will not happen on its own just by doing what you're told to do and getting A's. A vivid illustration of this commercial nature occupied the front page of USA Today about a week ago on June 12th. The headline read, "In Debt Before You Start," and its text informed the reader that the average college graduate owes $19,300 in debt. Here's a classic example of how you lie with statistics. The average college graduate owes $19,300 in debt, but not all the people who go to college borrow money. In fact, 62% do and 38% don't. So the debt of the borrowing class, if we can call them that, is much, much higher than 19,000. An actual average for borrowers would be above 30,000. That's greeting you at age 21 or so. I want you to face what this means candidly. Colleges peddle a product which 62% of the customer base can't afford without credit. They have to mortgage their future income to pay for it, much as is done with a house. And they know that there are little voices in your head saying, and it's as valuable or more valuable than a house. A really big difference between home ownership and degree ownership, however, is that with a home, you can actually see and inspect what you're buying. You can kick the doors, flush the toilets, check for termites. No such inspection procedure is available for diplomas or degrees. What you buy, plain and simple, is a pig in a poke. And having spent my 6 years at Cornell and Columbia, two of the lesser Ivy institutions, I can't remember a single class that I was signed up for that made any intellectual impact on me at all. I snuck that did, but none that I was allotted by the college did that. So what you buy, plain and simple, is a pig and a poke. And I think that's much more important than the simple statement might convey. If Highland High School or Harvard wants to conceal vital information from you on, for its own reasons, in the ordinary course of events, you have no way at all to know what Harvard is concealing. And I'll get to what that is in just a little while. Students and parents must take what's offered by any school exclusively on hearsay or faith. Thus, borrowers are at a substantial risk. But notice, nobody else in the school equation is. The bankers, for instance, who make the college loans, take no risk at all. Under our particular, peculiar banking scheme, they are allowed to invent the money they loan out of thin air. And if the debtor dies or otherwise manages to escape the obligation to repay, nothing is lost. The penalty to the loan issuing institution varies from very light to nothing, just as it is for the larger bad loans to Togo or Cameroon. While on the good side of bad loans, they create work, including some very cozy jobs for school principals, superintendents, college administrators, college faculty. Since students and families bear all the risk, they need access to all the relevant information, yet they're lied to systematically and closed out of most of the information loop. Take Joe Palazzolo, featured on the front page of the USA Today article I was telling you about in Dead Before You Start. Having just emerged from a socially marginal school, Rutgers, with a nondescript degree in something called public policy, Joe and his cover photo looked to be a very impressive 100 pounds overweight from the typical college diet. And he's in debt up to his ears, owing $116,000 from student loans, plus interest, of course. Whatever he paid in cash to exit Rutgers, it fell $116,000 short. I always read with a pen in hand, and I'll tell you a successful lesson that an uncle of mine taught me. He said, I'll loan you any books in my library, but if they come back to me fit to be read by anyone else, he said, I'm going to be very angry at you. You mark these books up and argue with them. So I pass that on to my public school students with what other thought the men in the book room. Anyway, so Joe's about 100 pounds overweight, and he owes 116,000. So reading with pen in hand, even though I don't consider myself cruel or thoughtless, I wrote on Joe's forehead, you were doomed. And then I noticed that I had done that. I think Joe knows this because, now you look up on your internet this June 12th issue and you'll see Joe is the main picture on the front page and the corners of his mouth are turned down like the opposite of a smiley face. They're turned down sharply and he has the look in his eyes of a man about to face a firing squad. Rates on loans from the government are 6.8%, and private loans from 7.5% to 8.2% at the moment. For Emily Weinberg, who graduated last year from Ithaca College with a degree in cinema, she owes $130,000. That will cost Emily, age 23 of Fairfax, Virginia, about $10,000 a year in interest without ever touching the principal, all other things being equal, Emily will be 53 years old before her dad is gone. Joe Palazzolo is quoted by the paper in words as sad as the look on his doomed face. "What did I do wrong?" he asked. "I did everything I was supposed to do." And I put a stage direction on here. Repeat slowly twice, but you can repeat it in your mind. "What did I do wrong? I did everything I was supposed to do." Now, simply apply the exact same calculus you would in buying a house to Joe's dilemma, and of course apply it before it occurred. Someone had knocked on Joe's door while he was a senior in high school and told him that in exchange for a mere $116,000 in cash, more than he had, an interest at 6.8%, he could have some neat public policy insight. Would he have taken the deal? Especially since those same public policy insights occur in many paperback books. Would his folks have allowed? Or try this alternative way of connecting Joe's resources with the college? What if he had passed the storefront with a big sign in the window that said, "Public policy theories, only $116,000 today"? Would he actually have gone in to buy them? So something strange is at work. Remember also, and this is something that struck me in about my second year of teaching, that with the magic of compound interest, simply depositing $116,000 in the bank would have compounded itself without much trouble into a fairly enormous sum by the time that Joe was in his middle years. And if you added into that capital sum what it cost to send him from first to 12th grade, we would be talking about a sum well in excess of $1 million. And that would include every kid in Harlem, Spanish Harlem, in New York City. I understand the drawbacks in this kind of reasoning. Nevertheless, just on the face of it, you would eliminate poverty instantly. I don't know what you'd do with all those hundreds of thousands of people who make their living, naturally helping children, make their living. I mean, it's like a fruit tree. Anyway, what about Emily? I love movies myself, but if someone whispered to my kids that they could actually think about movies for 6 years and it would only cost them $130,000 more than they could afford, plus yearly interest of 8.2%, Emily borrowed hers from a private bank, I think the spirit of Jack and the Beanstalk had come along and was prowling the land, devouring innocent victims. Time you put a bell on this cat. The stampede to college, which happened over the course of my now long lifetime, is devoid of any moral coherence. It defies the evidence of our own experience. It has morphed into a colossal parasite, eating our energy and resources. Now, of course, that kind of thinking got me thrown out of Highland High School. And no wonder stampeding children is their bread and butter. Great business for bankers, professors, publishers, test makers, bus builders. It's the number one profit item in the national equation. The construction industry, building and tearing down schools, is the number one single profit maker for the construction industry. What you have to do since you're in Albany is when they have the state education convention, you've got to get over there to that monument to Rockefeller, that plaza, and just take a look at the businesses that set up there. You'll see stretched out on that quadrangle, six or eight school buses, each representing a windfall for some bus company or other. And you folks, and I guess I'm a New Yorker now too, have seen to it that a law has been passed that no school bus can be operated that's more than 4 years old. They're put up in an auction. And because they're auctioned for 10 to 15% of what they cost new, I'm as greedy as the next Pittsburgher. I went to one of these auctions years ago before it happened, and I asked the mechanic in the garage, well, what condition are these buses in? And he looked at me as though I was mad. He said, they're in perfect condition. Perfect. He said, you'd be crazy with the insurance liability not to keep them that way. And I said, well, no, wait a minute. This bus that cost $150,000 was auctioned off last year for $10,000. What's the sense of that? I don't know. He said, that's the law. You'd have to imagine who's behind the law that compels the sale of these buses that are exactly like new. And you should wonder about that because you and I are paying for them. Anyway, so, well, what about Harvard? They've surely remained pure and above the sordid fray. I spent some time, several years, looking into the admissions policies at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. And what I discovered was something close to unbelievable. They prefer to bet on sure things, on students who will win regardless of whether they attend Harvard, go somewhere else, or don't go to college at all. And here's some proof of that. In the last few years, there have been several studies of successful applicants to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton who decided, for whatever reason, not to attend one of those exalted places, but rather they went to either a common college, like Joe did, or no college at all. Would it surprise you to learn that using familiar statistical parameters like income, career prominence, stable marriages, and a bunch of other similar things, that the no thanks pool was in a statistical tie with those who did the full tour of duty and carried away the prestige diploma? This is a lot more important. If I were in my dramatic years, I definitely would repeat that again. But you must think about that. You must grave that into your mind. A degree from these famous schools would have made absolutely no difference at all. None. Zero. That's what Harvard is hiding. Or truly knows this. Now, are you surprised? I hope so. But how does Harvard hedge its bets to assure a harvest of prominent graduates? Year after year, how does it successfully make itself appear special while rigging the game? In a front page story in the New York Times, March 9th, 2004, the admissions director of Harvard College announced that 80% of the many, many valedictorians who apply are rejected. The valedictorians got that one wrong. Having the highest grades in your school doesn't impress Harvard at all. Neither does having high SAT scores, and for a good reason. Harvard sits there with mountains of data showing it that those scores are absolutely irrelevant. Irrelevant in what regard, you might say, in a minute. Harvard, said the director, Marvin Lewis, against those who bring records of distinction. Recall that the elimination of standardized test scores and grades means that those aren't evidence of distinction. And I'm sure that being a member of the Glee Club and having a part in senior play doesn't distinguish you either. Colleges like Harvard, which depend on what the Dallas Cowboys calls the wow factor in its cheerleaders, knows that a wow factor admission upon graduation can be milked endlessly for donations, publicity, and favors of all sorts, lifelong, and probably after death, too. Colleges like Harvard know that a track record of distinction prior to high school graduation is its best guarantee of distinction after college graduation. The problem with kids who've invested all their time earning grades and worrying about test scores is that they don't end up successful all that often, probably because they've wasted too much of their time being misled away from really important things. Franklin Delano Roosevelt boasted to his mother in what was once, when I was in high school, a famous letter, which now is never mentioned, that he had achieved the gentleman's see. That was and is today a coded expression, meaning he spent just enough time on schoolwork not to appear to be a boat rocker, a system sabotager, but not so much that he forgot to learn matters truly valuable, like relationships, leadership experience, practice and courage, good judgment, a wide selection of raw experiences, and association. You can't get those things if you're copying notes off the board and working an extra 2 or 3 hours on your homework. The real trick is to figure out what high rollers like the Harvard crowd will read as distinction if it's not grades and test scores. What then? Keep in mind that if you get accepted at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Stanford, that's de facto evidence you don't actually need to go there and waste 6 of your best year and an amount of money so large it would be better put in producing something besides a piece of paper. If you're accepted, Harvard's savvy in picking winners is really saying, we need you, but you don't need us. So if the big boys want to invest in you, you're much better off saying no and investing in yourself. Just think what Emily and Joe could have done instead with all those years at hand and all that money. Too late now, of course. They missed their chance, but you don't need to miss yours by going into debt up to your ears. Now, I don't think that got me thrown out of Highland High School. The important thing to remember is this is the United States of America in the year 2006, a prosperous community with no problems of race or poverty, where I would assume everyone is on the fast track to this college or that. And rather than just say, we don't like that talk, get out, they called the police, who entered the auditorium armed. Now, it's true they didn't have guns drawn, but they were ready in case I went for my piece. So keep looking for what might have sparked that kind of panic reaction. 7 days after the USA Today piece on Joe and Emily, that's the 19th of this month, Time Magazine did a full-page profile of a young man who didn't owe 1 cent of college debt because he didn't bother to go to college. Instead, This high school graduate, Blake Gottesman, became the personal assistant of George Bush in the White House, earning $95,000 a year and probably expense money too, I'm guessing. Anyway, when I tell you that Blake dated General Bush in high school, you're going to think you know the dirty secret, but I assure you, you don't. Instead of going to college, Blake went to the White House, where, according to Time magazine, I'm quoting now, he serves as a membrane between the president and the rest of the staff, a systems analyst, gatekeeper, and diplomat. White House lawyer Dan Bartlett calls Gottesman the unquestioned authority on whom the president wants in his limo, what member of Congress he'll admit to his office on Air Force One, and whether it's wise for a top aide to bring up a particular topic at a particular time. That's a nuanced quiver of skills, isn't it? Since he's in a position to embarrass the president on any given occasion, I think we can assume that he's conducting himself pretty competently. He got all this expertise somehow, while others his age were wasting their time as undergraduates. That's an important factor, I think, motivating him to apply to Harvard Graduate Business School without a college degree, into which he's been accepted for admission this fall. He just skipped the bachelor's degree. You might say, well, Bush called up for him, but I'm afraid I have to disappoint you. Blake initiated the process himself when at 19 he read a Boston Globe article titled Harvard Business School on a High School Diploma that described successful applicants without an undergraduate degree. He wrote an essay outlining these earlier cases, did some research with alumni and current students, and then made a pitch to Harvard based on his essay, his research, and a plan how he could contribute to classes at the business school without a bachelor's degree. Since Gottesman, as I said, is in a position to embarrass the president, I think it's fair to assume he keeps his position through competence, even without a degree, exactly, of course, as did George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Edison, Isaac Newton, Harry Truman, and, surprise, three British prime ministers of the 20th century. And the lion's share of distinctive men and women who've written in human history, very few of them have a college degree, including the colossal and frightening Chinese peasant, Shen Wenrong, who you're going to hear about up ahead. Tell Jerry they can't throw me out until you hear about Shen Wenrong, because the hair will stand up on your head. Even in our own world, with all its powerful determination to render young people passive and childish, because so many of us make a living from them that way, many teenagers produce distinction right under our noses. We don't notice because the record of early history has been carefully rewritten to direct attention away from this disturbing fact. The American Revolution was fought and officered mostly by teenagers and very young men. The old man of the revolution was George Washington at age 44. But Alexander Hamilton was 19 and the Marquis de Lafayette was 18 and so on and so on. Or perhaps we don't notice because the press makes each modern attempt of youthful distinction only a mere human interest story and may make it seem sui generis. They never group the cases together, which would suggest that some powerful principle is at work, which contradicts the modern custom of locking young human beings up in compounds at the pinnacle of their energy and imagination and calling most certainly are not. Childhood is the worst thing that ever happened to young people. It's a prison of low expectations and artificially imposed childishnesses. I think what might have gotten me thrown out of Highland, I suppose, was the grouping of such examples, which I'm about to do for you, to suggest there are many better things to do with your time and money than waste them and your youth on schooling. Addicted to memorizing bits of information, many of them incorrect, couldn't have constructed a Napster collectively, given a million years to work at it. In 2005, last year, Newsweek reported on a 15-year-old boy from a remote valley in Montana, Chris Paolini by name, who earned his first $5 million selling a fantasy called Aragon that he had written at 13 and 14 to Alfred Knopf. It sold 2.5 million copies. At age 21, Paolini wrote a sequel, Elvis, 681 pages in length. Its first printing was 1.3 million copies. A movie starring Jeremy Irons will be released at the end of this year. The rest of this story is so refreshingly unbelievable. I have to gird my loins for it. Mr. Paolini is on record as expressing no interest at all in college, not even Harvard. Why should he join the ranks of the living dead? You can be certain Harvard, however, would put him on its roster of distinctive young lives if he applied. They bet on sure things only, remember. Among other talents, Chris can weld and rivet, skills he learned in order to make possible his hobby of building medieval weaponry when he isn't walking alone in the Absaroka Mountains of Montana. He's making sharp broadswords and links of chainmail. Aragon, which earned him $5 million, was self-published at first. The family mortgaging their home to pay for it. Just digest that for a few seconds. Mom and Dad then quit their jobs and went on a fantastic tour from junior high school to junior high school. There's an irony there. Library to library to sell the book. At age 14 and 15, Chris was the family breadwinner, and he's quoted in Newsweek as saying, "If we didn't sell enough books, we didn't have food on the table." You don't have to do something glamorous like sailing around the world alone or writing a million-seller book to be distinctive in your early life. You just have to initiate a complex, daring project and either carry it off or kill yourself trying. The effort, the focus, gives you the distinction. I once knew an absolutely horrible 13-year-old boy named Dane Ruiz. I had to look because he had two horrible brothers named Dante and Devin. It was Dante, Devin, and Dane Ruiz, but we're talking about Dane here right now. He was a holy terror, a one-man class destruction crew who cut school often to spend his time in the charity ward at St. Luke's Hospital, holding hands with frightened poverty patients, getting IV drips or recovering from surgery. They didn't know Dane was a monster, because for them his life glowed with distinction. See that your own kids does too. Before Highland High bounced me, I had enough time to ask its juniors and seniors to reflect what it might mean that the current president had a 76 average in college and boasted of the fact at Harvard after winning, although he went to Yale, he lectured at Harvard and boasted of being a C student. While his defeated opponent, a strange-looking U.S. senator, had a 75 average at the same college. or that his defeated opponent in the previous election in 2000 flunked out of his first college and earned a C-minus average in his second. I told them the current vice president, only a heartbeat from the presidency, had flunked out of college twice, not once, twice. That John F. Kennedy was a C student in secondary school and a C student in college, just exactly like his model, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, although Roosevelt boasted of it, and I wasn't able to find Kennedy boasting. Before I was shown the door at Highland, I had time to tell the students that Paul Wellstone, the legendary progressive senator from the Midwest, had a combined SAT score, verbal and math together, of exactly 800 in the days when 2400 would have been perfect. That's a 33 in anybody's calculations, but it didn't slow Wellstone down in the Senate any more than it did Bill Bradley, three-time senator from New Jersey and a presidential hopeful once, whose record on the verbal section of the SAT was 70 points below George Bush's, and Bush's number was on the lowest end of the mediocre range. Before armed men stopped my lecture at Highland High, there's a distinction there. I mean, you got to be doing something right to call the police. I was able to reassure the young audience that contrary to what schools always imply, grade point averages and SAT scores correlate very, very poorly with success. And that's why Harvard doesn't take them much into account in their admissions procedure. They're looking for the payoff after graduation to give it to A students or SAT whizzes. Likely not to get a nickel. A considerable number of productive, famous, and rich people enter the race of life without distinction on these fraudulent parameters of quality. The kids got to hear that Ted Turner, founder of CNN and one-time husband of Jane Fonda, flunked out of college and didn't bother to go back. That's the important thing in the name you're going to hear. They didn't bother to go back. That Francis S. Collins, head of the Human Genome Project, was homeschooled. And that Craig Venter, his main scientific rival, was thrown out of high school as a rotten kid, then went to fight in Vietnam as a buck private, not an officer. John Mackey, founder of the Whole Foods market chain, dropped out or was pitched out 6 times. The founder of Kinko's was written off as hopelessly dyslexic, a moron, by experts. And Edmund Hamilton, the largest mail order book dealer in the United States, sent me a letter crediting his dominance in the book field to the 4-year head start he had over his competitors by not warming a college chair, copying notes from a blackboard. Tell me, how can your kids negotiate the shoal waters of the dishonest world we've given them unless they have data like this to conjure with? How can you? Garbage in, garbage out, they tell me. Isn't that right? They tell me because I don't use a computer. And I threw my computer away 2 years ago. I've lived a long life, attended 2 Ivy colleges and a handful of others, taught with distinction, was named New York State or New York City Teacher of the Year on 5 occasions, and in all my life, to the best of my memory, I have never encountered a single soul, not one, who spoke of the intellectual excitement of college. Oh yes, I had an individual professor here and there that excited me. But of the whole experience, no. There seems to be a good-natured, universal understanding, tempered with some cynicism, that the college enterprise is a racket, a vacation for young men and women before before they surrender to the wardens of the work world for life in the salt mines, a racket too for the faculty, which gains a warm cocoon for many otherwise unemployable men and women. That probably is too harshly put, it says right here, but that's a common story, making the rounds of the poker dance in the law school lounge at Columbia University, where I earned every cent of my senior tuition. The lawyers were too busy thinking about cases, I guess. They couldn't play poker very well. College teaching, it was once explained to me by a drunken instructor at Cornell who crashed a Delta Tau Delta party in which I was the social chairman. Looking, he said, I quote, to score a succulent co-ed, college teaching serves the same function the ministry used to. Business, medicine, law, and the military life occupy the best youth destined for management. Teaching is a convenient dumping ground for others who would undermine their betters if sinecures weren't provided. This is all being said to me by an instructor trying to get into the fraternity party. He was an English teacher, I remember. Foundation grants serve much the same function of co-opting troublemakers. Whatever the degree of truth there is in what I just said, surely something is at work behind the scenes, stifling any serious questioning of the entire school institution and its very existence, including its expensive collegiate aura. Like medicine, school and college is best swallowed quickly without asking too many questions if you know what's good for you. Now, run your mind over this proposition, this common sense proposition. If grade point averages and SATs delivered any significant information about a man or a woman's quality, then making important judgments on the basis of that information would only be sensible behavior. In fact, not to make such judgments would be irresponsible to the point of recklessness. And following that argument, all of us deserve to know this assessment data about everyone significant in our life. Has anyone in this audience ever asked a minister, a priest, or a rabbi what his SAT score was or her SAT score? Has anybody in this audience ever seriously asked a wife or a husband? Did you ever once in your life hire a beautician, a grass cutter, an attorney, a physician, an architect, or an auto mechanic by first extracting their SAT score or their grade point average and then using that to factor into your decision? I would submit to you that if you did that on occasion, that I would have to be much more tender in this statement. But I happen to know, without knowing many of you here, that you've never done that, which means your heart and your head understand what garbage these things are, and you have just cut a kind of peace inside yourself, since there's nothing you think you can do about it. Although that isn't true either, that you're just going to put up with it. Well, don't have your kids put up with it. Bartleby the Scrivener, Herman Melville's famous maddening short story, celebrates the line, "I prefer not to." You don't have to pick it or break windows. I prefer not to take these standardized tests. Very good. Because they have not been shown in 100 years of trying to correlate with anything. If some of you, the only reason I've learned how to use the internet is to get some kind of a national infection going, prefer not to take these tests, you would gut a $40 billion a year industry. industry, we could start there with one of the good things that would happen. Did you ever bother to inquire of your kids' teachers what their GPA or SAT score was? How could you possibly, again, be so irresponsible? Isn't that significant data? You want them to be confined with dunces? In fact, I would go to my local school now, a little long in the tooth, that. But if I were involved in a local school, I would demand that all those scores be posted, including the principals, or otherwise that information about my son or daughter would not be public knowledge either to the faculty. Again, I don't think you have to be crazy about this. It's a simple demand. Why are you giving these tests? Because this is valuable information, that I want to know what your score is. I happen to know from a book published by the New York Times in 1999 that school superintendents as a coherent occupational group have the single lowest SAT scores around. How about that, superintendents? Elementary school teachers are down there, junior high school teachers are down there, senior high school teachers are down there, but superintendents are like 50 points away from the bottom. Anyway, we both know the information is worthless. It has no predictive power in matters of interest to ordinary, intelligent people. What it does do is to disclose how reflexively the subject was willing to memorize what they were told to memorize. Do as they were ordered to do. As the score goes up, so does the predictable conformity. It really is that simple. Why then are tens of billions of dollars and a significant fraction of school time devoted to these idle exercises which can't even qualify a body for admission to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Stanford? Think of them as a vast illusion, a sortie into the realm of performance magic, where the key to success lies in misdirecting audience attention from the real center of action. Misdirection is the best weapon of mass instruction in a social engineer's arsenal, and our economy depends on the predictable ability of most of us to swallow that bait. Let me give you a sickening example, and then I'll give you a break, and we'll conclude after you take 5 minutes free from my voice. I presume that almost everybody sitting here who drives has had the sickening feeling a $60 fill-up, and we have been directed to look at a variety of Middle Eastern countries as the reason for this horrible detour of productive funds in individual lives into the gas coffers. There are some people in here, not quite my age, but raise your hand if you lived through the Second World War. Okay. Let me tell you something incontrovertible. That is, this does not bear argument. 60 years ago, a major industrial nation conducted the major war, as far as I know, in human history, filling its Air Force gas tanks with gasoline, aviation fuel made from low-grade coal, and running its domestic economy 50% on the same fuel. I want to tell you a few things about this fuel. Chemically, it's indistinguishable from the the stuff refined from oil out of the ground. How about that? This was discovered not in Nazi Germany, but 100 years ago. They're using a process called Fischer-Tropsch, which I guarantee you 3 years from now, every one of you will be hearing until you're sick of it. Using a process called Fischer-Tropsch, not only can you convert bad coal into first-class diesel or gasoline, but you can also scrub in the manufacturing process all the blues out of it. Now, not all. That's a term I used to know when I was an English teacher. But 99.5% of the pollutants, the sulfur is gone from it. And you say, yeah, but what would you pay for something like that? How about substantially less than half the price for bringing it out of the ground? How does a broken down, overweight junior high school teacher know this? Well, several ways. One, there's at least one major nation on Earth, or prominent nation on Earth, that's been using this for the last 30 years. That's South Africa, which gets about half of its fuel needs at very low cost. The fuel is first class. It doesn't pollute. The United States has far and away the largest coal reserves in the world. Number two is Russia. Number three is China. The reason you're beginning, if you look hard to hear about Fischer-Tropsch, is there are at least four companies out there. I gave Jerry this news today. They jumped about 10% each today, so you might want to know. Well, that'll help them jump on them. There's four little companies that are about to, no, two big and two small companies that are about to blow the whistle. Many decades long silence about this. One's a Denver company that's going to open a demonstration facility in December. I guarantee you that in January, it's all you'll be reading about in every newspaper and magazine in the United States. And one is a company from Tulsa, Oklahoma, that's already signed a contract with the U.S. Air Force. I happened by accident. You know, you get a Sunday New York Times, and once you're crazy, sports section of the Newsweek Virginia to throw it away, but I actually go through every page, and I don't write and I read every word. But 2 weeks ago, I saw that Centrolium, another small company, had signed a contract with the U.S. Air Force, and the president of the company was quoted as follows. So it's a big article, lots of words. Nobody reads this kind of article. He said, I can make 42 gallons of aviation fuel from $10 worth of coal. That is worth repeating, right? In your tons. 42 gallons of fuel from $10 worth of coal. The governor of Montana has been bitching for at least the last 3 years, but I'm sure he's considered a raving lunatic. He put op-ed pieces in the paper saying there's more coal in Montana alone to fill all the domestic needs for fuel for the next 190 years, and that's just Montana. Now, I didn't step aside from this script to talk to you about anything other than misdirection. Were this some debatable proposition, we would have known all our lives that there is an alternative, a cheap alternative, and a clean alternative to buying oil from the Middle East. We would have known that. And responsible people may well have argued one way or another against availing ourselves of that. But the fact that you've never heard of this before, when a major war was run, so we're not talking about hypotheses. A major war was run with this stuff. It's the best illustration of misdirection I can think of. I'd like you to know that this lecture is dedicated to the best doctor in Houston, Texas, who's sitting right over there, Creaney Stowe. I believe she got her Harvard and her law degree from Yale, but maybe it's the reverse. I don't want to know which it is. And her mother, Maria. Is Maria here? Where are you, Maria?
Oh, gee, I can't see without my glasses.
Maria, Trini's mother, is this kind of human being. I've never met before. She had made this magnificent ring by hammering some old piece of silverware into a ring shape and then putting a big, powerful green stone in it. And I really admired it, upon which she immediately took it off her hand and gave it to weigh about a pound. So I staggered there. But these are special people, and I'd like to honor them by dedicating this collection to them. Now, back to business here. So, why, if $40 billion are devoted to these idle exercises, just reconnecting with where we left off, why are they perpetuated year after year when we know from a variety of sources that they correlate with nothing except a measure of obedience? And the answer is that they're to misdirect your attention away from the actual purposes of institutional schooling, which are being achieved brilliantly, or at least were up until the rise of China. Because of the intensely mercenary aspect of college training and the relentless propaganda that you and your kids will be ruined without the degree, it's very hard to think clearly about the thing. The best place to begin deprogramming yourself of the propaganda which leads to the college addiction is to keep foremost in your mind the inconvenient fact that one in every five of the most prosperous Americans came to their wealth through a trade like bulldozer operator or dog walker. Actually, in last year's Forbes 400 wealthiest people in the United States, 150 of the 400 were largely unschooled. That's 3 out of 8, so that's 37.5%. But 20%, and I got this up a PhD thesis at Duke University, I wasn't writing an answer, just pointing out the oddity that we never hear about this. The standard way this is done is as follows. First, you become the operator, and you achieve some deep insight into that particular trade, whatever it is, and its clientele. And then you become a broker of the service. You stop doing it yourself. You assemble people to do it, and you become the middle person between, you know, the buyers and the sellers of the labor. But the secret is employing the labor of others on a freelance basis or an independent contractor basis, charging more for the labor of others than you pay. I mean, the principle is simple enough for a third grader to understand. In 1968, I became aware of a 13-year-old boy in my West Side Manhattan neighborhood who was making more money than his mother and father combined by training his junior high school classmates to be dog walkers and pet sitters, then brokering their services to the inexhaustible army of desperate men and women, my wife and I being one of those, high-rise building, who require such attention to their birds, fish, cats, dogs, frogs, snakes, whatever. Because he had no overhead to speak of, he had access to the cheapest labor pool possible. No pet store could compete. 6 years later, when Brian Bantley, that was his name, his contemporaries were in college, this fellow was a Broadway producer. Whether equally successful in that act of madness or not, I have no knowledge. chance to succeed in that business. Do you need to go to college? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think so. But if you listen to the world's richest man, Bill Gates, you certainly do. On February the 28th, 2005, Gates addressed 50 American governors in a speech heard around the world. He said America was in a kind of economic crisis we had never faced before. That's certainly true. China and India were producing millions of trained scientists and technicians with which it would soon prove impossible to compete unless college training were made the national priority. All high schools, said Gates, should offer pre-college training, and only that, to everyone. And everyone in high school should be sent to college, subsidized if it were otherwise unaffordable. I was speaking in China when I heard this dramatic declaration. It fascinated my Chinese hosts, even dumbfounded. I was dumbfounded too, but for different reasons. I knew, for instance, that Bill Gates was quietly opening engineering campuses in China and India through which to acquire tech talent at 1/6 the U.S. rate of pay. So I knew it would be pie in the sky to believe that given the skill he needed at 16 cents on the dollar, he or anybody else would remain loyal to homegrown talent, regardless of how many years of college training the homeboys could offer. But the biggest anomaly in Gates' talk for me was the glaring fact that Gates himself had dropped out of Harvard, and more to the point, he never bothered to return. And if that weren't enough, he entered into partnership with another college dropout, Paul Allen, to found Microsoft. Allen never returned to classrooms either. What could this mean? The plot gets much thicker. This do as I say, not as I do rhetoric. To the average innocent mind, Gates' principal competition comes from Apple, founded by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, both college dropouts. Jobs had exactly one semester at Reed College. Neither went back, not after their first billion, not after their 10th, or after their 20th. Why not, if college is so vitally important? Another key billionaire in the computer hierarchy, Michael Dell, is also a dropout. Three courses, and he said this is a waste of time. In fact, Gates, Allen, Jobs, and Wozniak surely knew very well. They would have also known that Larry Ellison, the billionaire CEO of Oracle, is a dropout too. Why the silence on this when the rest of us are being dragooned into an extension of our childhood? Wasn't this interesting enough to warrant a comment, at least, by any of the newspapers that covered this? Without being fantastical about it, a pretty good case could be made that America's globally dominant computer industry would not be dominant at all without its dropout pioneers. Come to think of it, the connection of those dots alone might be what got me pitched out of Highland High School in my ear by men with guns, no less. I'll only take a little more of your time to tell you that America's globally dominant fast food industry is completely, 100%, the product of elementary school dropouts, junior high school dropouts, and high school dropouts. Because Eric Schlosser does that brilliantly in his classic Fast Food Nation, and if you haven't read it, I mean, run from this room and get a hold of it. It is a life-transforming book. Once you've read it for the fun of it, read it carefully there, because it's truly hair-raising. Nor will I bore you with the obvious fact that America's globally dominant film and music industries are almost totally, the number's about 92%, not good for sure. About a year ago, I read the obituary of Lou Wasserman, who more than any other human being created the shape of the Hollywood that we've lived through all our lives. And I read the Wasserman obit with a fine-tooth comb, because it picked up. He was, of course, a dropout, but not your garden variety dropout. Wasserman was an usher in a Hollywood movie house, and he worked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon to midnight, 7 days a week. It's a 63-hour week, and he's 13 years old right now. So he doesn't want to waste his time in school anymore, and he cooks up a deal to sell to the principal, the deal as follows. Wasserman said, "You don't have enough money for band uniforms or for sports uniforms. I can provide you with a way to get that money in exchange for marking me present." How about this? Now, far be it for me to condemn the man who said, "Okay, what was the deal?" Wasserman said that I have access to all these Hollywood films, and the theater doesn't open until 3 in the afternoon. I'll race them over to the high school. We'll show them for like a nickel a pop, and then I'll race them back, and no one will be the wiser. How about that? So, in the time when the other kids were going to high school, Wasserman took over a bankrupt talent agency, MCA. It was just a desk and a naked light bulb and back rent due. Took it over, and while he was in high school, he signed Fred Astaire and another list of incredible names to contracts. And suddenly MCA was back in the business. He also was so dissatisfied with the legal instruments that were there to bind talent to capital that he, the high school dropout, rewrote the laws, the show business law, the relevant show business laws, which I read in the New Yorker are still in force today, studied in law school. Now comes the big moment. I want to give you the frightening story of Shen Went Wrong, which I read in the Financial Times of March 18th this year. So it's about 100 days old. You will weep to hear it if you're still alive, I hope. The problem was moving one of the largest steel mills in the world from Germany to China. It was the legendary Phoenix plant in Dortmund, which had made cannon for Prussia, field guns and warship armor for the German Empire, and it had been doing that for 200 years. It was larger than 100 football fields and employed 10,000 workers. The college-educated policy staff of ThyssenKrupp and its highly sophisticated analysts estimated that this move would take 3 full years. It would require, take a deep breath, 40 tons of instructions to reassemble Phoenix after its 250 billion pounds of plant had been disassembled and shipped. You see, the smart boys figured out steel was going down the tube, and they dumped it on the ignorant Chinese. And then they were going to sell them a 3-year package to move it. And then they would say, "Oh, by by the way, here are 40 tons of instructions in German to reassemble this mill. Father, the mighty German steel firm, packed full of college-trained executives and the best engineers in Europe, delivered that estimate. 3 years, they said. In January of 2002, try to make a picture in your head, because this will be, this tied at least with the most amazing story you ever heard in your life. In January of 2002, 1,000 ignorant Chinese appeared in Dortmund, Germany, not a single college graduate among them. They built their own living quarters and commissary on site in 1 week. And 1 year later, after working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week without any union rules or safety equipment, the Phoenix plant had been moved to China and, for good measure, the same crew used its spare time to build a five-star hotel to accommodate the customers for this new steel mill in China, and it built wide boulevards to grace the town of Jinfeng so it wouldn't look tacky when people came to buy the steel. Story gets better. The company began as a village workshop in China 30 years ago in the town of Jinfeng, which is not far from Shanghai. A peasant farmer with only the most rudimentary schooling turned the workshop into one of the world's most effective steel producers, Shen Wenrong. There's a name to remember. I'm sure Harvard would give him a degree if he asked. Even an MBA, like Jenna Bush's boyfriend, would get. Shen Wenrong is a big man with ham hands, appropriately suitable for the farm laborer he recently was. His desk for business is a kid's school desk, and there's not a computer in evidence anywhere. He was born in a peasant shack in the delta where the Yangtze River meets the ocean. He lived out a childhood as poor as it's possible to live in one of the world's most impoverished countries. In that respect, he resembles Lula da Silva, the current president of Brazil, who grew up in the worst ghettos of Rio, making it to national leadership himself with hardly a whiff of school and no college. Shen Wenrong pays his employees 40 cents an hour, making him by far one of the most generous employers in his country. His workers love him, and he them. What's missing so far from this horrifying fairy tale is how Shen Wenrong outboxed the college-trained Germans. He knew a few things the Germans might have known but had overlooked, hadn't factored into their calculations, such as the fact that China was making such large purchases of steel that the price of the metal would soon go through the ceiling. There wasn't enough to go around. And the price would go so high that Phoenix would have been a big money maker even if it had been kept in Germany by Tyson Krupp. He knew also that Phoenix made the automotive steel for Volkswagen, and that VW, having just built a large plant near Shanghai, should be delighted to continue buying steel from the plant it was familiar with. The college-educated policymakers of Tyson Krupp might actually have possessed these facts in their vast computerized data banks, but like so many school-trained thinkers, they didn't know how to connect the dots. Too many standardized tests? I don't know. If you find yourself struggling with the significance of what I've told you so far, including the terrifying implications of the fact that a rich white high school far from the ghettos of New York City couldn't bear to face the fact that a school teacher had come to tell them the party was nearly over, that students needed to be told the truth, then another nugget of data from the celestial kingdom may bring the crime of forced schooling into sharper focus for you. than 110,000 public schools, more than 12,000 private parochial schools, and in all of these, an estimated 50,000 American students study Chinese. But in China, 400 million Chinese are studying English. And wherever I went, in Shanghai, in Beijing, in Guangzhou, in Xi'an, everyone I ran into spoke English, including the cab drivers. Everybody spoke English. How does that sound to you? Is that evidence that our pedagogy is going to protect us from the formidable challenge coming out of the East? Or is it evidence that Highland High School's see no evil, hear no evil policy is a disease gone deep into the bone and is killing us? And if our schools and colleges miss that boat on something that important, what other balls have they been fumbling? That's a mixed metaphor, by the way, that could earn me a red check demerit from a school teacher. But very few school teachers could actually tell you why they aren't allowed. How about an issue like fundamental health? An epidemic of diabetes is sweeping the country as I speak, reaching down all the way to age 5. It's the leading American cause of blindness, the leading cause of limb amputation, and second or third leading cause of heart attacks. A small fraction of this epidemic is hereditary, but the principal cause is bad diet and inactivity. Once contracted, it appears to be incurable for most people, so it's no joke. Bad diet and inactivity create a bonanza for the medical industry, but only grief and sadness for lives tainted with diabetes. Schools are and have always been the principal institution devoted to inactivity and bad diet. Because of constant political pressure, schools have never been allowed to effectively focus on what not to eat. Dangerous food, after all, is the staff of life to some of the biggest corporations on earth and to the medical industry, which consumes 12.5% of our gross national product, even though it must be obvious we are a long way from being a healthy nation. We've known for quite a while that schools aren't safe places for kids. Violence and low-grade terror are the unacknowledged lingua franca at places like Highland High School. But if you can't count on school routines and school food to keep your kid from diabetes, what exactly is the point of this irrelevant institution, at least irrelevant from the point of view of a young life and the people who love that young life? Besides a piece of paper and a whopping pile of debt, what exactly is its value to the individual? High school and college are a deadly 1-2 punch of an economic order and a social order, increasingly adrift from what really matters. A woman in Illinois recently asked me how to substitute for the college experience her daughter would miss if she did something else. "It isn't hard," I said. "Buy her a case of beer, a case of wine, a case of whiskey, give her a half pound of weed and some rolling paper, a few tabs of decent acid, and some porn videos like Frisky Coeds. Put a sign at your front door reading, 'My daughter is available for random sexual adventures with strangers.' That and a full set of Monarch Notes crib books should cover the lot of it." College experience. My wife told me to leave that part out. Put steel in your backbone. I'm going to conclude with the stories of three fascinating young women who didn't go to college. They're all recent stories, and all of them illustrate what I believe are the hidden resources in every one of us. All of them are true, all verifiable, force yourself to face what they mean. The first story is from 1987 to 1989. It concerns a teenage girl who was a serious troublemaker in high school and a bad, bad daughter at home. Tanya Aibi was her name, a Brooklyn teenager who had been thrown out of high school several times. But in 1987, she dropped out to sail around the world alone in a 26-foot boat. She had no particular interest in sailing and not very much experience. Her principal motive was to spite her father, who had hurled the challenge at her in exasperation. Tanya cheated on her Coast Guard tests and left New York Harbor without any clear idea how to navigate. But in a hurricane on Bermuda, she figured out how to read charts in a hurry. 2 years later, she returned to New York Harbor, the first woman in human history known to have sailed around the world alone. Her book, Maiden Voyage, is well worth your time to read if your librarian can get it from the interlibrary system. The second story is from the late 1990s, when a young girl dropped out of school at age 16 to go to England on her own, without a chaperone, and to enroll in a course which promised the teacher to drive faster than 200 miles an hour for hour after hour. She had no prior driving experience. It had been in go-karts only. At age 23, 7 years afterward, Danica Patrick almost won the Indianapolis 500, and indeed would have won, but her pit crew had mistakenly put too little fuel in her car, so she only finished fourth. That earned her $330,000 and $10 million more in product endorsements. Danica is the only woman ever to have held a lead in Indianapolis in the history of the race, and she has changed professional auto racing forever. The third story is the wildest one of all. It's a tale of a strange-looking, 5-foot-11-inch, skinny-as-a-stick Eskimo girl from the bleak Soviet city of Ulan Ubi in Siberia. Her name is Irina Penteva, and her autobiography, Siberian Dream, you absolutely must own. It is an epic of the human spirit unleashed, and it should correct any lingering ideas you have that a 13-year-old kid isn't a human being fully competent. At 13, Irina's Siberian, the name of the book, Siberian Dream, Irina's Siberian Dream was to be a supermodel. At age 13, a Chinese talent scout for a whorehouse in northwestern China lured Irina and some of her friends away from school with the promise of modeling careers in China. But in due course, they were deposited into a whorehouse, penniless, unable to speak Chinese, and in Irina's case, pregnant, soon pregnant. Okay now, role play, you're a social worker. Predict Irina's future prospect. No college for her, that's certain. And you know what Bill Gates says the chances of making it without a degree are. Fortunately for Irina, she hadn't swallowed some of the key assumptions that hold our social order together. But she did know that she was in a tight spot, and panic wouldn't help her, and there was no one to turn to for help. With other girls from the whorehouse, Irina escaped and set out to flee China. Believe it or not, if you've seen those old Mickey Rooney movies where they raise money for the football team uniforms, believe it or not, this little group stayed alive. This little group exclusively of girls stayed alive by putting on variety shows for Chinese villages, a desperate endeavor which eventually produced enough trained fair to get out of China with her infant daughter and go where, you might ask? No assets, no friends who can help. What would you do? Go home, of course, but not for Irina, who had a dream that by cleaning toilets and by hook and by crook, Irina eventually made her way to Paris Springs. Her book will supply the blow-by-blow details. Month after month, in between menial jobs, she made the rounds of modeling agencies, only to be told again and again that she was funny-looking and not model material. 3 years passed in this fashion, sleeping on floors, trying to keep her kid, now 6 years old, alive, and you think you have problems. But her dream wasn't dead yet. If France wouldn't work, perhaps America would. Parking her daughter with a friend, she wangled a visa and arrived in New York City at age 18 with $15 in her pocket and an overnight bag, destitute, homeless, friendless, and of course, without any school diploma. And funny-looking Eskimo, alone in the big city with no college prospects. 1 year later, Irina was on the covers of Vogue and Harper's Bazaar, a fixture at the best parties on the East Side. She had a role in a Woody Allen movie and was earning $5,000 an hour. So take that, you know-it-alls. Take that, stupid pseudo-scientific assumptions. Tanya, Danica, Irina, they represent for me a promise concealed in all of us before institutional schooling, including institutional college, steals it away and smothers it. Tanya, Danica, Irina. School would actively have discouraged all three. The first of sailing around the world alone without any training. The second roaring around a racetrack at 226 miles an hour. The third from heading for the United States, fresh from a Chinese whorehouse with an infant in tow, instead of going back home and going back to school. The loss of vitality to our body politic, the loss of real wealth to our whole society, which we pay when school bleeds away our own Siberian dreams, is a disgrace and a crime with few parallels. What we get in exchange are pinched, debt-ridden, unimaginative, cowardly lives. We become people who whine, like Joe, but we did everything we were asked. And now why has everything gone wrong? Like Doom Joe Palazzolo. Confinement schooling has only the most artificial connection with opportunity. It's a connection illegitimately preserved by preempting huge chunks of available work, then rationing it out through licensing, supposedly to those who present the best grades and test scores. Even that's a lie, as you now know. If we continue in this fashion, the day will come when the American experiment with liberty, self-reliance, free speech, and universal opportunity will simply vanish, overrun by those nations and the Shen Wen Rongs who can do American schooling with functions even better than we do. Already 85% of the merchandise in Walmart is made in China. Medical tourism to eastern lands where complex operations are available for pennies on the dollar will soon erode the pricing power of American high-tech medicine, and nobody's job is safe, only the jobs of bankers and politicians. The best response to these deadly challenges is through the imagination, not through tests and the discipline of bell-driven routines. We need to reimagine, to redevelop a rich inner life, which will then flower in invention and creativity. Once we had 90% of all the patents on planet occur. So we know how to bring that about again. We can have it again. The methods are written all over earlier American history, right up to the time of forced schooling, which was the gift to us of Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, and a handful of other industrialists had nothing whatsoever to do with the will of the people. Nothing. The secret is the secret of jazz, the infinite inventiveness of the unshackled imagination. It isn't hard to do, but it's impossible to do while the Highland High Schools of America impose a chokehold on free thought and debate. Meanwhile, back at Chicken Little High School, what do the students think about the case I present? According to the newspaper article rendered speechless, a senior named Chris Hart thanked the school board for inviting me to speak and wished that more students had been allowed to hear the message. Katie Hanley and Junior liked the talk for its new perspective and for getting her to think for herself. Quint Gallo, a junior, found me inspiring, as did a teacher, Elisa Driller-Colangelo, who said her class had exciting exchanges about the ideas following the talk. And a school board member at Highland was quoted in the newspaper this way. Mr. Gatto basically told them they were not serving kids well, that students needed to be told the truth, to be given real-life learning experience, be responsible for their own education. That the best lives are self-organizing lives. Gatto questioned the validity and relevance of standardized tests, the prison atmosphere of school, and the lack of relevant experience given students. Students were eager to discuss the issues raised. Unfortunately, our school didn't allow that dialogue. I can't tell you whether your kid needs to go to high school or college. But if, like Bill Gates, you think that either will save the nation from the horrible fix it's currently in, or save you personally, I know something you need more than college. You need your head exam. Thank you.
West Coast,
north of Eugene, some group that calls itself Quo Vadis, had organized about 150 people in a wilderness camp, and they were starting from scratch, back and forth with one another. The fact that we have 2.5 million homeschoolers now, and at least 40% of them follow the model called unschooling, the assumptions that have been drilled into us are what is wrong. When I go to China, and I've been there 6 times in the last 3 years, the American businesses that arise from the imagination, some of them are loathsome businesses, like fast food, but what fast food sells isn't food at all. I'm not being at all sarcastic. What they sell is a return to childhood, a bright-lit room, soft, mushy food, 2 flavors exactly. Not 3. One is intensely salty, and the other one is intensely sweet. Clean toilets to get rid of the food, and a show to watch. You can watch the people at the other tables. I go to China, let me tell you, there are many more fast food outlets per square block in China than you ever see here except in Las Vegas. They're packed to the gunnels with Chinese young people, packed to the gunnels, whereas this exquisite 5,000-year-old cuisine that balances textures and flavors is available, certainly not for more money than McDonald's meal would cost. They're patronized too, but not nearly to the same extent. All over China you find huge outdoor television sets, you know, 10-foot by 20-foot screens, and audiences sitting watching, get ready for this, the Minnesota Timberwolves play the Dallas Mavericks. That was in a tea house on the Pearl River. I saw that. In McDonald's, every second Chinese has a computer open. And that probably is part of the reason they speak English so well. So many of them speak English. But in fact, a heavy percentage of them are playing American computer games. Whoever. Now, all the games are built around murder, so I guess it doesn't matter if they murder or addiction to violence. At the Chinese Shanghai Conservatory of Music, the oldest continuous music school in the world, it would be like a great European conservatory in the 18th century, perhaps, and very, very proud of what it does. American State Department paid several black jazz musicians from New Orleans to go over and talk about jazz. You can find an account of this in the New Yorker magazine. The two guys were referred to by their first name, Willie and Dwight, and they were minor league jazz musicians from New Orleans. And they were informed front of the assembled student body that the theory of jazz couldn't possibly be true. And so they asked the star pupil in the school to come down and play his star composition. He played it once, and they improvised on it for 90 minutes with piano and bass. They improvised on it for 90 minutes, and the jaws of the audience went open. When you pay the price that China is paying, and we once paid, the price is your imagination. You can follow or you can tear down a steel mill 3 times faster than, you know, expert engineers say it can be done. You can do that. But what you can't do is think very well. That's a rhetorical flourish. I will say this, that after 21, if you want to salvage yourself, it's long, hard, grueling, and what you can do in short time when you're in early one of the wealthiest countries in the history of the world, and certainly the freest nation in the history of the world, to drain all the children out of the community under the threat of police intervention and turn them over to a set of absolute strangers for 12 years. The idea, on the face of it, is insane. From inside that system, I can tell you it's insane. It doesn't work even when it appears to work. We'll save that for another lecture. By seducing you, by traducing you, to think that the measure of accomplishment is a grade point average or standardized test, when the measure of accomplishment is writing a novel at 13 or 14, or sailing around the world alone at 17, or sitting and holding the hands of people getting IV drips or scared out of their mind.
That's what came to my mind. You see, when you were talking about debt and banks and money, people owe for college, and I said, man, that's scary. I mean, I never had this college versus money thing because I grew up in a country where you don't actually have to pay for college.
Pay it off, and I'm like 53, and then you're a free woman.
Yeah, exactly. So I was thinking, like, okay, if a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, who actually I think you, many of you know, was not in debt after only 3 weeks in college, correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, 3 weeks of college, he was in debt. Okay, so the only thing that was standing between him and the sea, sailing around the world or doing something else, and going and working for Arrow, was that college debt. So if there was no college debt, I think Isaac would probably be sailing around the world and not working for us this past year. Yeah, he had paid off in a month, though, so that's it. But the initial incentive for Isaac to actually start doing something with us and
no,
not sail away was the college.
Major came without having walked from one coast to the other. And if you have some...
There's one question here. There are two questions here.
It's blink your eyes, and there are thousands and thousands of useful things that need done. This is Maria, who's in her spare time, and she's not being a physician.
Sorry. This is Maria. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you to comment about the recent gift to the Gates Foundation by the second wealthiest person in the world. It seemed to me, I watched Gates a number of times, and I don't mean this in any personal negative way, but he doesn't seem to be a very bright guy. He gave a lecture at Columbia, my alma mater, unfortunately, and he said that the person who was, I think it was Murrow, who said, Mr. Gates, you've just gotten into philanthropy recently. Is it because you were so busy? And he said, yes, I was very busy making money, so I didn't have time to do philanthropy. Now that I've had the money, I can do philanthropy, which I found absurd and ridiculous and total BS. But I find that this combination is not going to accomplish anything. I think it's very significant from a medical perspective. The money that the Gates Foundation has spent has been on immunizing kids. But then the hook is, that we don't know about, is that the next immunization is up to the government of that country, and it's not going to happen. And so it seems that this game playing between these two gives the illusion that there's God out there who's going to take care of everybody, and that's a very dangerous assumption. And also, Mr. Gates makes all kinds of assumptions about his own intelligence, which seems to me are extremely inappropriate. Then my next question is just, do you think that people have just, we're not progressing, but degressing, and we're not hardwired to deal with communities of this size? Maybe not more than maybe 2 or 3 thousand.
I think, Maria, that we've been inculcated for generations by a whole lot of sort of false assumptions about what motivates human beings and how we progress. And in Gates' case, I don't want to demonize Gates. I think that he has a profound underhanded component when he trains people to take his work at 1/6 of the income, and no mention is ever made of that. You should say, well, Mr. Gates, my kid goes and takes an engineering degree. Can he expect a fair shot of being hired at an American middle class dealer? Will you have to compete with your Indian and Chinese graduates there? I mean, somebody needs to put a bell on the damn cat. But I'll say this, you know, when you come on strong in a short presentation, there's a bit of unfairness involved. All of us, every one of us, I've lived long enough to believe this to be true, every one of us has Adolf Hitler and all the other people in the world as a possibility in us. We're all capable of great good, great evil, and all the gradations in between. I think that if Mr. Gates is a duplicitous section of his character, he also has run into the Midas phenomenon, that it doesn't matter whether you have $44 billion or only $4 billion. You couldn't possibly, using your current imagination, spend it in 20 lifetimes or 120 lifetimes. So he wants something that has gravitas. He wants to be remembered, not as a rich, sappy-looking fool who made a system so bad that he was denounced about 10 years ago in the Wall Street Journal, that took 3 full pages to say if anyone had ever foisted an invention this flawed on the general public that wastes millions of hours of human time every year because it's just badly designed and badly put together, that they hardly would be considered a national hero. That's the Wall Street Journal speaking, not me. Buffett, I have an awful lot of affection for. You got to read Buffett's autobiography to find out that by the age of his Kansas City, which is like a hellhole in the summer, Omaha, which is like a hellhole in the summer, at the age of 6, he had his first business going, and it isn't that he made a good buck because he did in the middle of the Depression. It's that he served a need that wasn't being met. There was no air conditioning to speak of, and what he did was go around with ice cold cokes. That was a heavy load. Age 6, and he made a penny a bottle. He'd knock on doors and sell you ice cold cokes. He used the capital that he raised from that. And I don't want to spoil the book for you. By the time he was 18, he applied to Wharton School of Business. He had 5 separate streams of income, and he was earning the equivalent inflation adjusted of about $150,000 a year, and Wharton turned him down, which is a big break for him. He didn't have to waste his time being told what he could have taught. I think Buffett, as I would, I mean, I have a 128-acre farm, not too far from here, about a 3-hour drive from here, and I'm desperately trying to race the grave digger to make it something that, you know, the world will be a little better for. I paid for a billboard. It says Solitude, a place for reflection, and you're all welcome. Go to my website and get directions to get over there. The only thing is, there won't be any cost. I even have tents to loan you right now because I haven't managed to find somebody to put up the money for cabins. But it's Solitude. You can say hello, and I certainly don't want to hear it from you until you say goodbye. Give you a map of the place. Is that, or is that your dear? Or is that
there, there's a question over here. Karen, and, I live in New Paltz, which is the neighboring community to Highland, New York. I live next door. I mean, it's the next door town. And I'm a teacher, a public school teacher in New Paltz Central Schools. And at the time that this happened, of course, I was very interested in it because I had seen you at Omega. And as far as I knew, you were a rational person at that point. And when I was listening to my fellow teachers talk about what happened in our neighboring community, of course, teachers about it, because basically it sounded like you were going off the deep end, and they were talking about a film that you had seen, and I wanted you had shown, and I wanted to know what the film was called.
That was what they call a red herring or a white something or other. I showed a short film, 22 minutes, that had been shown on the Discovery Channel, so it hardly could have been. In the film, there happened to be some scenes, not of the actual shootings, but of the high schools where the shootings took place. That occupied perhaps 60 seconds out of the whole thing. Remember, when you summon the police, you're going to have to justify that to somebody else, you know. And the excuse given in the papers was that while that might be appropriate for, you know, older people, it wasn't appropriate for the lie. Of course, if you've been taught a little bit of the formal rules of thinking, as I was in third grade by the Jesuits at a private boarding school who taught us the dialectic in third grade. Well, I guess other people were reading funny animal books. If that explanation were true, then why would you cancel the meeting with the parents that evening, all of whom were, we would assume, 40, 50, 60 years old? But the film's been shown all over the United States. For the last 4 years, I guess desperate's the wrong word, but we've been fighting an uphill battle, and I have surrendered as of a week ago to raise enough money to make a full-length feature film which would bring people up to speed on where schools came from, why they took the shape they took, how they managed to resist change in the face of continuous criticism. It's not just a recent phenomenon. And we were going to tell the history of schooling in an animated central section. And there's a whole bunch of first-rate documentaries about schools. Nobody watches them, but they preach to the choir. The only way to crack this institution is to have a full-length Technicolor documentary with an animated section and voiceovers by Eddie Murphy, who agreed to do it as a comp. Jennifer Connelly, who agreed to do our voiceovers as a comp. I mean, these are multi-million-dollar fee people. Lou Latham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, said he would do the section on elite private boarding schools, because what we could talk about if we had a week here is the vast difference between the targets of elite private boarding schools and the targets of so-called gifted and talented program. They're miles apart from one another. Yes?
Hi, I'm Emily. I go to Scarsdale Alternative School. I go to Scarsdale Alternative School, and I was wondering what your opinion was on education for education's sake and learning because kids enjoy learning.
It's the only thing that's worth a damn. Education and schooling are two different things. Schooling has some value. You know, I learned in a couple hours how to blindfold and take a rifle apart and put it back together again. Or you can learn how to impound the water supply of northern Germany. It'll take a few years, but you can learn how to do that. All of these things are mostly by rote, not completely. But think of that as a kind of instrumental training. What education is the development of judgment, personal philosophy, the ability to write your own script, to weigh nuances. It doesn't work, it doesn't happen inside of a classroom of strangers who either hate one another or lust after one another or are sweating because it doesn't happen. All you have to do is wipe away the sappy, sentimental assumptions and look at any classroom. None of them work. They don't work. Mine look like they work so well. And part partly sometimes they did, but they looked like they worked so well because I had such a strong personal relationship with each student in the class that the truth is, and I only came to see this painfully because it was so much fun to go home, that they were looking to please me. You know, when I'd leave the room and go down the hall, I'd have 30 or 40 kids following up because I was a lot skinnier, better looking than them. But I said, this is crap. I'm just training to be followers a different way. You know, and I went back in and I read the Riot Act. I said, you know, no more of that. You wiggle your hand in the air. If you care about grades, I'll mark your grades down. You know, and if you know how to answer fluently in class, don't ever let me see your hand up again. You've already mastered how to speak in front of a group of strangers. If you want some real stuff to sink your teeth in, you'll work out a private curriculum. That isn't very hard to do. And those of you who are mothers and fathers probably have done that to some extent. Just take the brakes off. Full speed ahead. A record of distinction. You have to learn 18. Otherwise, as the gentleman in the front here says, you can make up for that. But it is so hard and so painful that most people quit trying, in my experience. Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me, there's a question here and a question there. I've asked a question.
That's her daughter. That's Marini Stowe. Marina, is that the best compliment that you've had for our group or something?
John, you talked a little bit about the issue of, you know, do you ask your whatever about their SAT scores or their GPA? I wanted you to talk a little bit about the issue of licensure certification and the way in which, in medicine, it is the easiest to be able to talk about, one I'm most familiar with, but it actually is now the case that we have infiltrated the whole standardized testing sort of jargon, licensure certification stuff is so much an umbrella in terms of the practice of medicine in this country that it is becoming difficult. And not only have we already done licensure, that's entirely about multiple choice exams. No more is there any apprenticeship. No more is there any clinical test. It's all about checking the A, B, or the C. Now we've also gotten to the point where you now need board certification in a specialty to be able to get access to hospital care, et cetera. And actually, the public has now been trained. The first question out of people's mouths, many people, is, are you board certified in X? So it's now becoming, you know, it's not a GPA or an SAT, but it is there this stamp of a multiple choice test on your forehead that says you're incompetent? And what we've seen in terms of the condition of medicine as a result is the flailing and failing of the system, and physicians who basically are automatons who can't think. And we have horrific mess in terms of anything that's left of healing in this country, in terms of the practice of medicine, versus, for example, my grandfather's practicing 40, 50 years ago. We had no technology, we had human beings. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that phenomenon elsewhere, because it exists all over the place. Increasingly, people are certified credential. The people are certified as lactation consultants. People are certified. There are more letters after people's names in my lifetime than I ever would imagine possible.
Cree asked me to talk about a phenomenon that she's a physician, that she's spotted, and you've all spotted in medicine. Let me, for shorthand, call it the corporatizing or scientizing of medicine, which operates on an assumption that it's pretty easy to see. It's seriously flawed that you can, in fact, prepare treatments for generic mass of people and then can be done by a computer, and so can diagnose it sometimes. But that phenomenon's everywhere, and you should expect that it's in every institution. You should expect that the centralizing and the automatizing process simply builds on itself in a positivistic way from generation to generation. I did notice, I had in my own family growing up, three, I would say, brilliant physicians. One went to medical school in his middle 40s. He had been the assistant superintendent of Pittsburgh schools. And he came home one day, I heard this from my mother, and said, I can't bear to work in a business this dishonest anymore. more. So he goes to medical school in the middle 40s, and he graduates second to third in his class at the University of Chicago. And the other two were comparable work, though frequently the conversations would be about the ideas and the philosophy of medicine. You know, it's not that they got enough of the office when they came home. It was really their passion and their love. Movement attracted my attention, and when you're my age, that also causes a little lot to fall apart. So anyway, I had not a prejudicial outlook on medicine. My closest associates were the three uncles that had influences on me. When I went into the Army as a medic, possibly thinking that maybe I'd go back to school, and that my uncle said that they could arrange it to be a doctor. So I was a medic in the Army, and then I switched to the Coast Guard because I heard that they got to go to Bermuda on ships, and I was a medic on a destroyer that went to Bermuda. It was a tremendous amount of fun. From face-to-face interaction with medical people, I got a very, very bad impression. And in college, from interaction, often in poker games, with pre-med students and medical students, I got a very, very bad impression that the number part, not just the money, that too, but the number part, the mechanical part, the quantification of treatment was some spirit loose in the air, and it wiped out any sense of what. Now, I'm not speaking as a man having any position on Fidel Castro at all or on Cuba, but as I've traveled around the world over the past 10 years, I must tell you that I have never, not a single time, and I read newspapers compulsively. The town has three papers, I read all three. If it's London, you got nuts. It's 10 of them. But I read them all. Never seen a good word about American medicine, and now I'm going to come to the real point. I never saw a bad word about Cuban medicine, and often I see it was the best medical system in the world, dollar for dollar, because what it had done was disperse all of the medical operations that could quickly and easily be learned through the neighborhood, so that in every neighborhood on the island, there were a number of people that you could go to for the common conditions, and they saved their small professional budget, I guess, for those conditions that were serious. But the general level of health, I reckon, I've not had firsthand experience with this, but like the fourth time in the Singapore Straits Times or the Hong Kong Morning Post, I'm reading big articles about Cuban medicine. Suddenly I see the logic of preempting and holding privileged information that you can sell is a hideous idea. It stands on another assumption that you can't trust ordinary people, that they aren't worth much. I don't want to shock anybody here, but that idea comes directly to us from Charles Darwin and his family. His cousin, Malthus, who said that we're so degraded and our lives are so horrible that we're better off being worked to death as fast as possible. That's the kindness to get rid of us. Darwin, of course, says, anybody in here have Irish on either side of their family? Can I see your hand if you have Irish? Well, if you're going to go to the local school and say, you know, you can't have David Duke. Well, let me tell you, pick up Darwin's Descent of Man and see what he has to say about the evolutionary status of the Irish. Just see. Because I won't repeat it because you're going to say, Jesus, God's radical. And just see what he says. I will say this, that if an Irisher crossbreeds with someone of advanced evolutionary stock, evolution will march backwards into the swirling mist of the dawnless past. So just be careful about taking up with an Irish. I might add, this is the same thing, though, about the Spanish and a number of other people. That's the fellow who's in every school in the United States. Can you imagine why? Yes.
I agree with you that homeschooling is a wonderful thing and it's very powerful. But what do you suggest for students who come from really bad home situations? I see a lot of these kids, and they come to school solely for the purpose of escaping from home.
Let me tell you what I used to say to them, because they would come to me often, and I had great respect and sympathy for them, and I never abused my mind in the notion that they were in any way inferior to anyone else. You know, they might have a different cosmetic exterior, but they think as well as anybody. But what I'd say to them when they came and bitched about their parents, they weren't all ghetto kids. I remember I had a rabbi's son come to me and the same thing. He had been adopted. The name was Bornstein, and he called himself Daniel Unbornstein in Clinton. And have almost invariably, not formulaic, but the same substance in the response. And say, look, I've lived a long time, and I've now come to the conclusion, I wish I'd come to it at your age, that if you don't have strong family ties, you don't have a good life, no matter how much money you have or how good life you want, you have to have those ties. And if the older people in your family cannot help you, then it's incumbent on you, even though you're 12 and 13, to be the father and mother in that family and to bring them out of this despair. You have that as an obligation. You can't flee your problems without turning into, I'll be brutally, Pittsburgh trash. When you run away from the problems, you become moral trash. And you never find your footing again. So you're much better off. And the implication, and I'm not accusing you of this, but the implication in what you said is that these kids from these bad backgrounds can't see reality and can't take steps. And I would really beg to differ. I strongly disbelieve that a 12-year-old person, man or woman, is a child or a student or somebody. What they lack in experience, they more than make up in acuity of perception, imagination, resilience, able to get up off the floor when they're knocked down. It's a hideous thing we've done. Read Franklin's autobiography and you'll see what Philadelphia was like in colonial days. It sounds like the most exciting place in the world. The streets are filled with people of every age interacting with one another on important things. Franklin, from a family of, I think, 16. Don't hold me that, might be 15, might be 17. So no spare money. He's not only working 60 hours a week and putting himself through this grueling curriculum, as are his friends, but he goes to England several times on his own. The energy that we waste trying to nail millions of young people into their coffins until they're dead. Until, as the 15-year-old boy said, they're the living dead. Now we'll turn them loose at 22 with a $116,000 debt. What do you think will happen to that guy? I know a miracle could happen, but I don't think it will. He'll be scared all his life. He'll be picked on by his employers because they'll know that he has no resources. And they've got it, I believe, written into the law that he can't go back. indentured servants in the banks.
I have two more questions up here.
Yes.
I have relatively good news. I'm sorry to hear about your questions.
A little bit louder, because I'm really...
No problem, this is better. I have a 12-year-old daughter who has done many of the things that you suggested all on our own. She's a straight-A student, decided to leave public school, done unschooling, attended a wonderful alternative school. My question is this. She herself, not by reading her books, compares herself to Benjamin Franklin and the author of Aragon, and I think she puts a lot of pressure on herself. You know, she does marvelous, amazing, wonderful things, and I know every parent thinks her child is a genius, so I'm not, exception. So, and I think her mom is a wonderful one. She says, but Benjamin Franklin did this. She names all these people, and she says, this is nothing compared to that. And sometimes I think that's, I don't want to tell her not to aspire like that, but I think, God, you have a nervous breakdown.
I absolutely believe, and I'm one of the founders of the New York State Conservative Party. Believe that. I've got a lot of remember because there were no conservatives in the Conservative Party. They're all radicals. Bad radicals. Anyway, let me deal with 12-year-old daughter this way to show you what's at stake and to give her a principle. The year before last in Washington, D.C., I was getting an award from a foundation, and sitting right next to me was an 11-year-old boy getting the same award, the same foundation, and it was a super fancy hotel. I kind of just love to call it room service. So his name was Andrew Sue, T-S-U, and now he'd be 13, I guess. Andrew had won the Washington State Science Fair at age 11. His parents were immigrant waiters from Taiwan. He had won the Washington State Science Fair. What was his project? It was sequencing a gene in common between mice and human beings. So, I'm looking at Amber sitting over there, and I, in a spare moment, I said, how did you go about doing this instead of playing baseball? Oh, I played baseball. I said, he said, I'm a champion swimmer. I have trouble. I said, well, how did you go about doing this instead of watching movies all night long? He said, when I was young, those are the first words I remember. When I was young, my grandfather told me about the trapped flea principle. Now, he didn't use those words. I heard his name. He told me about how you train fleas. We've sort of lost an understanding. The trained fleas go back hundreds and hundreds of years in history, and they were like a big show in an elegant court. And I've seen trained fleas. It used to be on 42nd Street. Then it was old Zion. On 42nd Street, it was a Hubert's Flea Circus in the basement of 42nd and Broadway. And,
am I not being heard in the back? Well, I better hold on to it. I'll forget. There. So, Hubert's Flea Circus, you get down there and you pay like a dime. This would be in 1954. And Hubert put his arm out, the fleas would all get a good drink of blood. And then they would swing on little trapezes. They would step into chariots drawn by fleas, and they would crack the whip, and the fleas would pull the chariot. It was quite amazing. This story is not just a human interest story, and I will quickly make it germane, I hope, to your lives, at least to your girl's life. So, what Andrew told me was, you can't train fleas to do anything until you break their spirit. How do you do that, Andrew? He said, if you put fleas in a shallow petri dish, they will instantly jump out. There will be a flea in there 3 seconds later. But if you put a lid on the petri dish for 1 or 2 hours, they will have hit their heads so often trying to get out that when you take the lid off, they won't try to escape. At that point, he said, they're eminently trainable. Well, when the last word was out of his mouth, I knew what I had been hired to do. I was the lid on the petri dish. And fortunately, I could amuse or entertain or even connect with the kids enough that the attempts to escape that hideous classroom were few and far between, and after a while I invented a way they didn't have to try to escape, that they had a blank check to escape 5 days a week if they wanted to. The track flea principle we put into play when we cede our judgment over our children to licensed strangers which you know nothing about. There can't be a more radical act in human history. If you said to me, I mean, they came to me with spear points and I had no choice, but they don't. They don't at all. And what does your kid think when you don't step in and take their side if they have a reasonable case? I know, because I lived with those kids for 30 years. They have contempt for you. Sometimes they despise you. But they know right away what they're supposed to know, that your family can't help you in any significant way. And your mother and father really work for the school, not for the family. And I'm making that purposely very, very strong, because the percentage of those extreme instances isn't very large. But if over and over again that the mother looks to you, a total stranger, for insight into her kid, what should the kid think? He knows, or she knows, that most of the people teaching, although they're not worse than the average human being, aren't even competent in their own supposed expertise. I'll give you the most flagrant example of that. In 30 years of teaching and 15 years of doing this all over the world, I have never met a science teacher who was a scientist. They're clerks who memorize what they're supposed to transmit. They transmit it. They're the lid on the classroom during the standardized examination. And they only do experiments of which the outcome is already known. What kind of a waste of time is that? For 12 years, we already know what's going to happen to a Prince Rupert drop or whatever. They don't even do that anymore. I have very seldom met an English teacher. I guess Dave Gooderson out in Washington is the most extreme exception to this rule, who uses language in their private life in any specialized way. They don't write, they don't make speeches, they hardly ever read complex literature, hardly ever. In what sense are they masters of the English language? And we can extend it. The only people I ever met in school who I would want to be with, I didn't know that when I was a kid, I'd want my art teachers, music teachers, who are very often drawn to the living, beating art community. They're trying to stay alive, you know, and they'll be as generous as the kids allow them to be, or even as your kid allows them to be. I mean, this is an insane system. It's insane. And just because it's quiet, just because the school has has pictures up on the wall in a football team. Don't think that incarcerating a kid for 12 years, then an additional 6 years, is going to finish them. Well, it'll finish them in the MFA. It's like a finishing school.
Two more questions.
No wonder we have a screwed up world. I mean, no wonder we have a screwed up world. I have an apartment in Spain, which Creamy actually stayed at because she speaks Spanish. And only in the last couple of years have I encountered unremitting hostility from, it's in the south of Spain, on the Mediterranean, unremitting hostility from the Islamic population. And I just came back from 6 or 7 weeks in Italy, and mostly in Sicily, where we met our son, and we're delighted to see the name Gatto all over the place, where you never see it here. And the difference was night and day between the human life over there, was so much richer. What I remember from my boyhood during the Second World War. But in addition, the Islamic population was unremittingly hostile wherever we went. We'd been doing this for 30 years. My wife's pocket was picked. The car was broken into. There was nothing in it but a Pittsburgh Steelers football program, and they threw that away to disgust. But all the rest of these people are like ghosts. Even the nice ones, the good ones, the dedicated ones like me, were ghosts. And for us to preempt the primary relationship just doesn't make sense. In order to make a living, we'd be better off getting an honest job. Yes, ma'am.
It's very hard to articulate because you've touched on so much here, but what's really coming up for me is we're all complicitous in some way in the maintenance of the system. And even when one tries individually to make a difference, and it seems from what you're articulating that one-to-one, like for example, your personal relationship made a difference. You're just saying, you know, parents, us as human beings, we can make that difference one-to-one. Nevertheless, what we're looking at is a huge system. And I don't have a sense yet of how to actually change. And let me just say the other part of this is that some of the examples that you gave of individuals who did make it, with the dropouts who made it and became multi-billionaires and blah, blah, they were all in industries like Hollywood, fast food, etc., where they end up making personal benefit and yet not manifesting spiritual principles like compassion or integrity or using their benefit for the good of all. So,
what about the kid who organized pet sitting and allowed people like me to go on vacation?
Okay, so there are some.
Going.
But actually, so that's the other part of the question. If we're going to impact systemic change, how do we also impact conscience, really?
I think the first thing that we all need to realize is this gigantic system's principal strength is your fear.
Okay, I said this gigantic system's principal strength is your fear. It doesn't seem to be that way, I know. And if you're under the lens and being persecuted by the attorneys from the school district, it must seem that this was a foolish gamble that you lost. But in fact, the system, even in New York City, can attend to very many people who say, I prefer not to, before its trained response is compromise. And I'll tell you something that I hope disgusts you to your core. There isn't a school in this country, I've only worked in 12, and as a school inspector for City University, so maybe another 30. But still, there's not a school in this country who doesn't cut private deals with people who can make trouble for it. Absolutely guaranteed. From the Lou Wasserman example, where he swapped stolen film showings for band uniforms and got his high school diploma, compliments of that swap, to the smallest thing, where you go in and you simply make the case that a teacher-student relationship, your kid and a certain teacher, is unacceptable and intolerable. That for whatever moral or intellectual reason, and you give indications without threatening. There's no need ever to threaten. These people are so uncertain in their jobs, the principals, the superintendents, and the APs. There are 20 people waiting for each one of those jobs. The only sin that they're punished for isn't destroying your kid. It's embarrassing the system. And you can embarrass the system as easily as picketing a principal or getting an article in a newspaper or sending a poison pen. Like if a guy embarrasses the system, he is on his way out. I didn't tell you that both the people in Highland are gone, the superintendent and the principal. I should have told you that. They embarrassed the system by calling the police. Try to imagine the inadequate personality that wouldn't first come up and say, hey, listen, this doesn't work for our kids. And, you know, I'm going to send them back to class. Or what would I do? Punch her in the nose? Who would call the police? They deserve to be gotten rid of, and they're gotten rid of. Will they ever get work again? I doubt it. I doubt it. They'll go around begging and doing office work in district offices somewhere, maybe in, no, not in Utah, the Mormons wouldn't have it, but somewhere, you know, maybe West Virginia. If you have a clear idea of the intensely political nature of this bill for business and what its weaknesses are, what it's intended to produce, and then what the obstacles to that production are, you can almost write your own ticket all the way through school. I would prefer personally that you said, would say, I prefer not to, and throw the gauntlet down. How come you can't do it? If the mothers in Scarsdale, about 6 years ago, does anybody know what I'm going to say next? They simply refused the school, Scarsdale High School. You know, every other car in front of Scarsdale High School is a Cadillac or a Maserati. Those are the kids, those are the faculty. They drive Saturdays. But they refused to allow the school to administer standardized tests. They said what is correct, that they're an hideous waste of time, they're a misfocus of attention, they're an act of magic, and it made the national press. Scarsdale is composed, I would imagine, of people who think they count, and they certainly think they count more than local pedagogues there. So they weren't buffaloed. They were used to success in their personal lives, and they would be damned if some teacher college product was going to waste their kids' time. Suddenly, I mean, it was day-to-day reporting, suddenly a media blackout. Not another story. The story didn't trail off, you know, the way you'd expect. It just stopped, and I knew dozens, if not hundreds, of deals like this. A deal had been cut where the people who went on the offensive, their kids didn't have to take the test. But all the rest of the slums did, the cowards. That would satisfy, probably they passed it through the State Department of Education. And what they knew is something you ought to always keep in mind, that when a flaming parent cohort is in a system, the system always retracts the pseudopods because it knows something. That as soon as their own kids are out, which is one in the high school, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, that the system can return to normal with all the champions gone. They're not going to stay around and fight for an idea. They're fighting for their own kids. This is a much weaker apparatus than you can imagine. What they spend the lion's share of your tax money on could not be justified in some kind of third-party court. There is no evidence that there's correlation between grades or standardized tests and anything else except the next grade you're going to get in the same subject, and the next score you're going to get in a standardized test. Wouldn't you, if you were making fortunes every year from this attempt to show hard numbers, even though those are mostly lies too, but nobody shows you hard numbers because they don't exist. Every attempt to show a correlation has failed. Some of them, this is grim, some of them show negative correlations. That is, higher your scores go, the less well you do. Those are frightening. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Distinction. I wonder if you can. I think distinction is so important. Like the purposes of school have to do with making for successful adults.
No. That is.
What I really want to ask you is if you could give some examples.
I'll give you a few. There are exactly six. And let's see how many of them I can call to mind. My source, by the way, is a book written by the secondary school editor at Houghton Mifflin, who was a professor at Harvard for many years, and after his premature death, Harvard named its honor lecturer in education after this guy. His name was Alexander Ingalls, but that's spelled I-N-G-L-I-S, and the honor lecturer is called the Ingalls Lecture. I heard about him in a book with the frightening title, The Child, the Parent, and the State, written by James Brian Conant for 30 years, the president of Harvard, and published in 1949. I can't believe my memory is actually serving here, but let's see how much farther it carries it. So in Child, Parent, and State, this massively important school figure, James Brian Conant, who is the real reason we have universal standardized testing, and the real reason we have gigantic high schools like Columbine with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 kids in. He said that some well-meaning people, this is 1949, are trying to unthread this system that was carefully built. He says, now I'm paraphrasing, he says in effect, that would be a very foolish thing to do because what would immediately follow is the collapse of the entire economy. So these people have a short-sighted look. He said the schools were set up in the period 1890 to 1910 to perform six functions. What had happened in that period was a transition from an entrepreneurial small farm economies to a centralized mass production factory economy. And the schools prior to that time, at least outside of urban areas, had no time to waste with indoctrination because the harvests had to be brought in and all the farm machinery had to be kept in repair without a mechanic base available to do that. In other words, the kids prior to the centralized mass production economy actually had to know how to do real stuff, or otherwise their families and their towns were in real trouble. However, Andrew Carnegie was the first, but John D. Rockefeller was right on his heels, and they worked in tandem. They saw that harnessing the power of coal and then oil was twice as efficient as coal, would allow every toy in human history to be hooked up to an unlimited power source, and they would actually run. Now, I'll drop dead right in front of you. If any one of you was taught in school that the Wright brothers did not fly the first airplane, there were regular flights of a coal-fired airplane up and down the Potomac River in full sight of the Congress, you know, the big shots in the country, for quite a long time before the Wright brothers got up. There was no one in the plane, but it got up and then flew, you know, a half a mile or whatever, down the river. It was powered by coal. So the flight had been achieved. It'd be like saying that the first human being in a space vehicle is actually the pioneer. We should tip our hats to when the monkeys were the first vehicle. You know, it's like a bus driver. In fact, it wasn't even like a bus driver. You just sit somebody in the seat and they're shot out there. So, with this transition to a mass production economy, several things had to be done. And if these sound sinister, I don't intend them to be that way. The leaders of any society have the responsibility to see to it that there's some kind of a regular income and that it's apportioned with some degree of fairness. So what makes a mass production economy work? Many of the things, not all, but many of the things that are mass produced are inferior to the things that are craft produced. Well, a couple of things have to happen, and they all were assembled in that period of time. For one, you have to redefine what human value is. This is done a lot of ways, from the pulpit, from magazine articles, from press articles, from influential people making remarks. You've got to redefine what life's about. A mass production economy will not work unless you redefine the value of life as owning stuff and owning the latest stuff. And when that's replaced or obsoleted, getting the other, you have to have people think that way, even if they don't think they think that way, they behave that way. The next thing you need are people who spend everything they have and then are given easy credit terms so they can mortgage their future indefinitely. You got to have both those things. You got to have people who are broken off from their children. It's Julius Caesar's divide and conquer principle. The family is the deadly enemy of a corporate society because the family contains sources of wisdom that often contradict the corporate pronouncement. And so you've got to break the family. There's a number of ways that is done and has been done. I mean, it's essentially succeeded in our country quite a while ago. But one way is to put the kids in competition with their parents and to seduce them into lives of appetite. At the same time, you have comedians and Just give me a second here, Ray, because this is a big
time. After this, there'll be a 5-minute break, and we'll get no.
This is a big time thing. You create a classroom environment where, A, it's impossible to concentrate with messengers or loudspeaker announcements or pull-out programs, so that there's never any time stitched together to concentrate, and you encourage the rise of a kind of outlaw mentality in the classroom, where the teacher can be mocked and humiliated, where weaker kids can be preyed on by stronger kids, where the snap and the insult is the lingua franca. This is an absolute brilliant piece of the design, because what it does, of course I can recall the first school I taught in New York City, I was strictly forbidden not to intervene in any children's contretemps because of legal liability. And when that stupid excuse didn't wash, there were other excuses. And finally, the Ford Foundation paid big money to establish a principle of due process for every offense in a New York City classroom. Every offense had to require a defense attorney for the kid, a scheduled meeting in front of the authorities, and, well, there may be 100 of those an hour. You can quickly see that the best way to deal with that, if you see somebody punching another kid or fondling a girl, is just to turn your back. I once walked into a classroom in New York City, in the middle of the prosperous Upper West Side. I used to try to get in there early in the morning, and some of the kids were there, and a girl who I knew well was stripped to the waist by a young fellow in the class who was very, very sophisticated, and I rather liked him. And I said, "Osmond, this is it." He said to me in the most gentle, patronizing voice, "Look," he said, "you're new in this school." He said, "if you send me down to the principal, look at your watch, I will be back in exactly 7 minutes. He said, "and nothing will happen other than that he will be angry at you for wasting his time. And then when I do this again, what are you going to do?" That was a 13-year-old boy speaking to, I guess I was 45 at the time. This is not uncommon. It's not confined to ghetto children. The prosperous kids simply have a different style in doing the same.
Okay, I just want to say that you have a plane at what time? 6 in the morning?
I'm there at 5.
You have to be there at 5.
I'm going to Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah, so you actually came in first cross.
My plane's at 5, going to Syracuse.
Now, tomorrow morning, 8:30, we'll have announcements here after breakfast. And if you have time to run down, there's a few more of his books left. If you want to run down, get him and come back, and he'll talk to people just for a few minutes afterwards, and then he's going to be whisked back. And I want to thank John for